A clock in the schoolroom struck 9. Miss Miller left her circle and, standing in the middle of the room, cried, "Silence! To your seats!" Discipline prevailed. In 5 minutes, the confused throng was resolved into order, and comparative silence quelled the babel clamor of tongues. The upper teachers now punctually resumed their posts, but still all seemed to wait. Ranged on benches down the sides of the room, the 80 girls sat motionless and erect. A quaint assemblage they appeared, all with plain locks combed from their faces, not a curl visible, in brown dresses made high, and surrounded by a narrow tucker about the throat, with little pockets of holland, shaped something like a Highlander's purse, tied in front of their frocks, and destined to serve the purpose of a work bag, all too wearing woolen stockings and country-made shoes fastened with brass buckles. Above 20 of those clad in this costume were full-grown girls, or rather, young women. It suited them ill, and gave an air of oddity even to the prettiest. I was still looking at them, and also at intervals examining the teachers, none of whom precisely pleased me, for the stout one was a little coarse, the dark one not a little fierce, the foreigner harsh and grotesque, and Miss Miller, poor thing, looked purple, weather-beaten and overworked, when, as my eye wandered from face to face, the whole school rose simultaneously, as if moved by a common spring. What was the matter? I had heard no order given. I was puzzled. Ere I had gathered my wits, the classes were again seated, but as all eyes were now turned to one point, mine followed the general direction, and encountered the personage who had received me last night. She stood at the bottom of the long room, on the hearth, for there was a fire at each end. She surveyed the two rows of girls silently and gravely. Miss Miller, approaching, seemed to ask her a question, and having received her answer, went back to her place and said aloud, "Monitor of the first class, fetch the globes!" While the direction was being executed, the lady consulted, moved slowly up the room. I suppose I have a considerable organ of veneration, for I retain yet the sense of admiring awe with which my eyes traced her steps. Seen now in broad daylight, she looked tall, fair and shapely, brown eyes with a benignant light in their irids, and a fine penciling of long lashes round, relieved the whiteness of her large front. On each of her temples her hair, of a very dark brown, was clustered in round curls, according to the fashion of those times, when neither smooth bands nor long ringlets were in vogue. Her dress, also in the mode of the day, was of purple cloth, relieved by a sort of Spanish trimming of black velvet. A gold watch—watches were not so common then as now—shone at her girdle. Let the reader add, to complete the picture, refined features, a complexion, if pale, clear, and a stately air and carriage, and he will have, at least, as clearly as words can give it, a correct idea of the exterior of Miss Temple. Maria Temple, as I afterwards saw the name written in a prayer book, entrusted to me to carry to church, the superintendent of Lowood, for such was this lady, having taken her seat before a pair of globes placed on one of the tables, summoned the first class round her, and commenced giving a lesson on geography. The lower classes were called by the teachers. Repetitions in history, grammar, etc., went on for an hour. Writing and arithmetic succeeded, and music lessons were given by Miss Temple to some of the elder girls. The duration of each lesson was measured by the clock, which at last struck 12. The superintendent rose. "I have a word to address to the pupils," said she. The tumult of cessation from lessons was already breaking forth, but it sank at her voice. She went on. "You had this morning a breakfast which you could not eat. You must be hungry. I have ordered that a lunch of bread and cheese shall be served to all. The teachers looked at her with a sort of surprise. "It is to be done on my responsibility," she added in an explanatory tone to them, and immediately afterwards left the room. The bread and cheese was presently brought in and distributed, to the high delight and refreshment of the whole school. The order was now given, "To the garden!" Each put on a coarse straw bonnet with strings of coloured calico and a cloak of grey frieze. I was similarly equipped, and following the stream, I made my way into the open air. The garden was a wide enclosure, surrounded with walls so high as to exclude every glimpse of prospect. A covered veranda ran down one side, and broad walks bordered a middle space divided into scores of little beds. These beds were assigned as gardens for the pupils to cultivate, and each bed had an owner. When full of flowers, they would doubtless look pretty, but now, at the latter end of January, all was wintry blight and brown decay. I shuddered as I stood and looked round me. It was an inclement day for outdoor exercise, not positively rainy, but darkened by a drizzling yellow fog. All underfoot was still soaking wet with the floods of yesterday. The stronger among the girls ran about and engaged in active games, but sundry pale and thin ones herded together for shelter and warmth in the veranda, and amongst these, as the dense mist penetrated to their shivering frames, I heard frequently the sound of a hollow cough. As yet, I had spoken to no one, nor did anybody seem to take notice of me. I stood lonely enough, but to that feeling of isolation I was accustomed, it did not oppress me much. I leant against a pillar of the veranda, drew my grey mantle close about me, and trying to forget the cold which nipped me without and the unsatisfied hunger which gnawed me within, delivered myself up to the employment of watching and thinking. My reflections were too undefined and fragmentary to merit record. I hardly yet knew where I was. Gateshead and my past life seemed floated away to an immeasurable distance. The present was vague and strange, and of the future I could form no conjecture. I looked round the convent-like garden, and then up at the house, a large building, half of which seemed grey and old, the other half quite new. The new part, containing the schoolroom and dormitory, was lit by mullioned and latticed windows, which gave it a church-like aspect. A stone tablet over the door bore this inscription: "Lowood Institution. This portion was rebuilt A.D. by Naomi Brocklehurst of Brocklehurst Hall in this county. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." St. Matthew 5:16. I read these words over and over again. I felt that an explanation belonged to them, and was unable fully to penetrate their import. I was still pondering the significance of institution, and endeavouring to make out a connection between the first words in the verse of Scripture, when the sound of a cough close behind made me turn my head. I saw a girl sitting on a stone bench near. She was bent over a book, on the perusal of which she seemed intent. From where I stood I could see the title. It was Rasselas, a name that struck me as strange and, consequently, attractive. In turning a leaf, she happened to look up, and I said to her directly, "Is your book interesting?" I had already formed the intention of asking her to lend it to me some day. "I like it," she answered, after a pause of a second or two, during which she examined me. "What is it about?" I continued. I hardly know where I found the hardihood thus to open a conversation with a stranger. The step was contrary to my nature and habits. But I think her occupation touched a chord of sympathy somewhere, for I too liked reading, though of a frivolous and childish kind. I could not digest or comprehend the serious or substantial.
You may look at it, replied the girl, offering me the book.
I did so. A brief examination convinced me that the contents were less taking than the title, Rasselas, looked dull to my trifling taste. I saw nothing about fairies, nothing about genii. No bright variety seemed spread over the closely printed pages. I returned it to her. She received it quietly, and without saying anything, she was about to relapse into her former studious mood. Again, I ventured to disturb her.
"Can you tell me what the writing on that stone over the door means? What is Lowood Institution?
This house, where you are come to live.
And why do they call it Institution? Is it in any way different from other schools?"
"It is partly a charity school. You and I and all the rest of us are charity children. I suppose you are an orphan. Are not either your father or your mother dead?"
"Both died before I can remember."
"Well, all the girls here have lost either one or both parents, and this is called an institution for educating orphans."
"Do we pay no money? Do they keep us for nothing?"
"We pay, or our friends pay, £15 a year for each."
"Then why do they call us charity children?"
"Because £15 is not enough for board and teaching, and the deficiency is supplied by subscription."
"Who subscribes?"
"Different, benevolent-minded ladies and gentlemen, in this neighbourhood and in London."
"Who was Naomi Brocklehurst?"
"The lady who built the new part of this house, as that tablet records, and whose son overlooks and directs everything here."
"Why?"
"Because he is treasurer and manager of the establishment."
"Then this house does not belong to that tall lady who wears a watch and who said we were to have some bread and cheese, to Miss Temple?"
"Oh, no. I wish it did. She has to answer to Mr. Brocklehurst for all she does. Mr. Brocklehurst buys all our food and all our clothes."
"Does he live here?"
"No. 2 miles off at a large hall."
"Is he a good man?"
"He is a clergyman, and is said to do a great deal of good."
"Did you say that tall lady was called Miss Temple?"
"Yes."
"And what are the other teachers called?"
"The one with the red cheeks is called Miss Smith. She attends to the work and cuts out, for we make our own clothes, our frocks and pelisses and everything. The little one with black hair is Miss Scatcherd. She teaches history and grammar, and hears the second-class repetitions. And the one who wears a shawl and has a pocket handkerchief tied to her side with a yellow ribbon is Madame Pirot. She comes from Lille in France and teaches French."
"Do you like the teachers?"
"Well enough."
"Do you like the little black one and the Madame, I cannot pronounce her name as you do?"
"Miss Scatcherd is hasty. You must take care not to offend her. Madame Pirot is not a bad sort of person."
"But Miss Temple is the best, isn't she?"
"Miss Temple is very good and very clever. She is above the rest, because she knows far more than they do."
"Have you been long here?"
2 years.
"Are you an orphan?"
"My mother is dead."
"Are you happy here?"
"You ask rather too many questions. I have given you answers enough for the present. Now, I want to read." But at that moment the summons sounded for dinner. All re-entered the house. The odour which now filled the refectory was scarcely more appetizing than that which had regaled our nostrils at breakfast. The dinner was served in 2 huge tin-plated vessels, whence rose a strong steam redolent of rancid fat. I found the mess to consist of indifferent potatoes and strange shreds of rusty meat, mixed and cooked together. Of this preparation, a tolerably abundant plateful was apportioned to each pupil. I ate what I could, and wondered within myself whether every day's fare would be like this.
After dinner, we immediately adjourned to the schoolroom. Lessons recommenced and were continued till 5 o'clock. The only marked event of the afternoon was that I saw the girl with whom I had conversed in the veranda dismissed in disgrace by Miss Scatcherd from a history class and sent to stand in the middle of the large schoolroom. The punishment seemed to me in a high degree ignominious, especially for so great a girl. She looked 13 or upwards. I expected she would show signs of great distress and shame, but to my surprise, she neither wept nor blushed. Composed, though grave, she stood the central mark of all eyes. "How can she bear it so quietly, so firmly?" I asked of myself. Were I in her place, it seems to me I should wish the earth to open and swallow me up. She looks as if she were thinking of something beyond her punishment, beyond her situation, of something not round her nor before her. I have heard of daydreams. Is she in a daydream now? Her eyes are fixed on the floor, but I am sure they do not see it. Her sight seems turned in, gone down into her heart. She is looking at what she can remember, I believe, not at what is really present. I wonder what sort of a girl she is, whether good or naughty. Soon after 5 p.m., we had another meal, consisting of a small mug of coffee and half a slice of brown bread. I devoured my bread and drank my coffee with relish, but I should have been glad of as much more. I was still hungry. Half an hour's recreation succeeded, then study, then the glass of water and the piece of oat cake, prayers, and bed. Such was my first day at Lowood.